Hello everyone, welcome to That Creative Life. Today's episode is with Ollie, who is a super talented YouTuber, and that is his second job. His first job is actually a junior doctor in the UK's National Health Service, aka NHS. So he shares a lot of cool behind the scenes of his job, but he's also kind of techie. So he released his iPad Pro review even before I have a chance to get mine out. So bravo, he's a better tech YouTuber than I am, and he's a doctor. He is way busier than me. Anyway, speaking of the iPad Pro, I'm actually recording this on the iPad Pro 2020. Apparently, you know, along with the MacBook, they have great microphones. It's very interesting that they focus on the microphone thing when usually, you know, you would think that that's the last thing that you would worry about. But hey, for mobile content creation, say I'm out and about, back in the day when we used to be so out and about, good times. You know, I could record some audio on my iPad. So tweet me, does this audio sound good? I want to say a special shout out to anyone who takes the time to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Thank you. That's really, with podcasts, the only indicator outside of my YouTube channel, youtube.com/thatcreativelife, where I have been posting actually full episodes so you guys can have some extra quarantine content to watch. But I really appreciate you guys leaving reviews. I actually look at them. I love the positivity, but I'm also looking at any feedback. You know, someone said that I talk about dropping out of college too much. And so maybe I can chill on that a little bit. You know, it's never in the light of me not liking education. I love education. I feel like I educate on the YouTubes about creative photo video. I'm just passionate about the other ways of learning that don't cost you $40,000 a year. Yeah, sometimes I break out into song when things get too serious. So, noted, you know. But thank you for leaving the feedback. And, you know, make sure you're following us on Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, wherever you want, really. I'm ranting now. Just wanted to remind you also that there's Q&As at the end of all of these That Creative Life podcasts that me personally, Sarah Peachy, answers. So if you guys ever have any questions on Twitter or YouTube, I take my favorite and I answer them at the end. And if you really want me to answer them, you can hashtag That Creative Life and I find them faster. So before we hop into things today, thank you, B&H Photo, so much for sponsoring this podcast. If you're not aware, B&H is the largest non-chain electronics retailer in the US. So cameras, video cameras, laptops, iPads. Maybe I'll talk a little bit more about the new iPad 2020 today. You can find it all at bnhphoto.com. As always, my affiliate links are down in the show notes below if you're curious what I use for my podcast equipment, my video cameras. I feel like, who says video cameras anymore? I mean, I guess, you know, an A7 III is technically a video camera. Why am I getting off on a tangent? Anyways, B&H Photo, we love you. They're so good at supporting the local creative community in New York City. They have amazing, great customer service and support online, especially during times like this. If you absolutely need something, and electronics, you can shop online with them and they have really fast shipping. So thank you, B&H Photo, for sponsoring this podcast. And without further ado, my interview with Ollie. Welcome to That Creative Life. Hi, my name is Sarah Dici and I am your host. I talk with artists, YouTubers, CEOs, and everyone in between. I hope this podcast helps you live your best creative life. Enjoy. Ollie, thank you so much for being on That Creative Life. You are so many things, doctor first, but then YouTuber, podcaster, content creator. I do not know how you find the time in the day. So thank you for being on the podcast.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. I've actually been listening to your podcast since day one, since you promised like a Casey Neistat episode.
Oh gosh, don't bring that up.
With like Gary Vee or something.
I think, oh, did I?
And I've yet to see that Casey Neistat episode.
Yeah. I think in the Gary Vee episode, I mentioned that. But then you learn very quickly that you don't tease anything with Casey until it's locked down because, yeah, he's a busy boy. But it's funny that I wrangled Gary. You'd think the other
other people would be possible if you can get Gary in a room.
Yeah, like that was incredible for episode one. Gary Vaynerchuk.
I know. It was such a good way to launch the pod. But it's cool because I was also on your podcast, Not Overthinking, with your brother. So I'll link that in the description below if people want to continue this journey after the podcast. And I just want to say thank you for enduring and having the patience with me as I try to set up the setup. Are you in London or an outer city? Where are you?
I am about 20 minutes from London.
Okay.
So it's a little town called St. Albans, which is sort of in the suburbs, sort of London-ish.
Love it. Yeah, because I want to do more podcasts that aren't necessarily in my office, but for the video clips, I wanted to do something where it looks like we're here talking to each other. So I have the TV set up behind me. So thank you for your patience. And as we kick off here, if you can kind of tell us a little bit about yourself, and also I feel like a good way to start is talk about the different schoolings of becoming a doctor, because as I understand, you're a junior doctor. What does that mean, and how much school have you gone through and will be going through?
Okay, cool. My name's Ali. I'm 25 years old and I'm a junior doctor. And basically in the UK, a junior doctor is everyone who is not a consultant. So I guess the equivalent is an attending in America. So if you're an intern or a resident in the UK, you're known as a sort of junior doctor because you're not yet a senior doctor, if that makes sense. So I've been a doctor for about 2 years now. I graduated med school in 2018 and I was there for 6 years. So kind of 6 years of med school, then 2 years of the foundation years of being a doctor, and then there's applying for residency and all that stuff. So that's kind of my day job. And then on the side, you know, the YouTube channel and the podcast recently. So
yeah, no, that's
kind of what I
that's
do.
That's awesome.
And that's the hustle.
And I guess it's a little bit different in the UK versus the US. But whenever I talk to a few of my friends that are pursuing, you know, being a doctor, it seems like the schooling never ends. But it seems like you have come to a point where after the 6 years, you can like you're actually practicing, right? Or is there how much more school do you have to have in terms of are you going to specialize? Talk to us like we're fourth graders here.
Okay, so after 6 years of medical school, at that point, you are qualified as a doctor, so you can start calling yourself, Dr. Ali or Dr. Mike or whatever you want to call yourself.
Ah, Dr. Mike, yes.
Exactly. Oh, what a legend. And then at that point, you still have loads of exams to take. Like if you want to specialize, you have to take medical exams and then you take your specialist, so cardiology exams or whatever you're doing. But crucially, you don't go back to university for those. You sort of study for them alongside your clinical kind of day job. And then you take those exams. Some of them are written papers, some of them are role plays, all this sort of stuff. And then eventually you become fully qualified as a cardiologist or as an interventional radiologist, as Chris Nichols is. You know.
Gotcha. Yeah. And what do you want to specialize in? Or do you have to specialize anything? Can you, because technically right now, are you a pediatrician? What are you?
Yeah, so
I don't even know how to ask these questions.
So it's kind of different to in the US. So in the US, straight after med school, you apply for residency. And at that point, you've decided that you want to become an obstetrician, for example, and that's the residency program you apply for. Whereas in the UK, you have these 2 years, which is what I'm doing, where you've got rotations in loads of different specialties. So at the moment, I'm on obstetrics and gynecology. So that's kind of what I'm doing for these 4 months. And then my next placement is stroke medicine. The placement before that was psychiatry. So we have a lot of these different rotations. And at the end of it, you sort of decide, do I want to go down medicine or do I want to go down surgery or do I want to become a general practitioner, so family medicine? You kind of choose your specialty after 2 years of being a doctor.
Gotcha.
And I'm thinking,
that's cool.
I'm vaguely considering anesthesiology, vaguely considering maybe moving to America for it. So we'll
see. Snap. I mean, that sounds interesting because then you get to explore, you get to dive in deeper to see, oh, wait, I'm really interested in this. This is what I want to spend the rest of my life in. Because that's such a big pressure to know because there's so much schooling. There's so much that you have to do. So why are you drawn to the US? Is anesthesia just really hopping over here?
Honestly, I'm kind of drawn to the US because it would feel like an adventure because yeah. I've been in Cambridge in the UK now for the last 8 years and I was having this real crisis of, you know, how do I figure out what to do with my life? And then I came across this exercise that they teach at Stanford Business School called the Odyssey Plan. Have you heard of this?
No, please explain.
Yeah, so it was on some other YouTuber that I watch. She was talking about the Odyssey plan. And the idea is that you imagine your life 5 years from now and you sort of write down in detail what your day-to-day life looks like. And so I wrote this down. I was like, okay, if I continue down my current path, I'll be a trainee anaesthetist, anesthesiologist in the UK. I'll be doing some teaching on the side. I'll be doing some YouTube. I'll be living in Cambridge. And I sort of felt that I kind of had this feeling of, is that it? And I felt like I wanted to have more of an adventure, especially because this YouTube thing is going well. It would be a bit of a shame to not take advantage of it while it's going well. And then along the same time as I was having this crisis, some friends of mine came over from the US and they moved over to do their residency there. And they were talking about how much of an adventure it was. And so that factor, plus the fact it would make for good content, means that I'm quite interested in the idea of moving to where you are.
So many things to unpack there. What do your peers think that you are doing YouTube and that you are, you know, you have a newsletter, you have a podcast, you have a YouTube channel that has 550,000 subscribers, but that means nothing nowadays because your views are fantastic. You know, hundreds of thousands of views. You have videos that have really popped off in productivity and even weaving in tech and like, you know, what you read and all those things. So you're a cool blend of things, but when you have these clips of day in life of a doctor, do your peers come through and like, what is that camera doing? What are you doing? What is that like?
Yeah, it's always a little bit weird. Like I was filming a day in the life last week and because normally for those videos, I film it on my phone and do it sort of surreptitiously. But last week I took the whole setup. I took the tripod, the A7 III, the monitor, the VideoMic Pro. And it was probably quite intimidating for the people on the ward because they were all like, oh, whoa, what is this? And because in medicine, you work with such a wide variety of people, people my age were like, oh, cool, can I be in the video? Whereas the nurses who were in their 40s and 50s were a bit more like, oh, this is a bit weird. What's going on?
Right.
But I think everyone was very supportive. And I think the trick is for me is to just sort of be shameless about doing it. And like, you know, if someone doesn't want to be in a video, that's absolutely fine. But I feel like I don't want to be apologetic about the fact that this is what I'm doing.
Right. And when did that start? Because I can only imagine when you're in med school, you're pretty busy, right? So were you watching something that gave you the motivation to make videos? Have you always made videos as like from a little kid? Where did that come from?
Oh, so it was in my fifth year of medical school out of six. I was on my elective, which is when we go to a random country for 2 months and do medicine stuff there. So I was in Cambodia doing plastic surgery because I thought that's what I wanted to do. And I was working in this like children's surgical center. But around that time, I started making like educational videos helping kids get into medical school because I knew a lot about the exams. And I had some courses that I was trying to kind of shill, getting, you know, preparing people for these exams. And I thought, you know, content marketing, why not create video content and do the sort of Tim Ferriss, Gary Vee approach of giving lots of content out for free. And then some people will convert and buy your course. So I started doing that for a few videos. And then very quickly, I around that time, I discovered Casey Neistat and Peter McKinnon and like the vlogging scene. And then I actually discovered your channel. And yours was actually one of the inspirations for like combining lots of different interests because you do the tech thing in a vloggy sort of style.
Yeah.
And I think at the time you were doing videos Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And yeah. I was like, wow, this is absolutely insane.
It was way too much. Yeah. But
so that, yeah. So that like that was like seeing that and seeing someone sort of my age doing it was such an inspiration for me deciding that, hang on, maybe I could do this vlogging thing. Mm-hmm. And not many people in the UK were doing the medical vlog thing. I think it's more of a thing in the US, but that was kind of what started it. And I kind of went from there.
Yeah, that's awesome. A lot of the advice that I give people when they want to start a YouTube channel, they seem like it's just that, oh, I'll learn how to make videos and then I'll make videos, but then they don't have any interest outside of it. And when you have something that you can pull from, you're pulling from your experience in the medicine field. I mean, that is so fascinating. That's something that you can help people who are going into that profession. But just from my standpoint, you know, you're curious, oh, what is it like? And how do they study for these exams? So mixing in your interests, your job with videos, I mean, that makes such a more compelling story.
I think so. I was always very concerned about sort of what the value add would be. And I think it was either something that you said or some other vlogger that I watched early on said that, you know, until the audience thinks of your content as valuable, they won't really care about what you're doing and, you know, when you're brushing your teeth and, you know, the standard vlog stuff. And so I was really big on the providing value first and sort of vlogging secondarily. And I think that that worked reasonably well.
No, yeah, that's fantastic. And so what was the first video that popped for you? Because you have some that, I mean, have popped.
Yeah. It was kind of like that thing that I think what Gary Vee says, that it only takes one piece of content to change your life, but you never know which one that's going to be. So you just keep on churning them out.
So you better keep, churning.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think like early on, I actually took a page out of your playbook, which was when I think you were talking about that video that you did, the famous Casey video. You said that you wanted to have like a back catalog of content so that if people discovered you, they wouldn't just see two videos on there. They would see kind of 100 videos on there and show that, oh, this girl's legit. Let me subscribe to her. And so I really took that to heart. And so I'd planned that I was going to have like a back catalog of content. And then like 8 months later, I was going to do a video about how to study for exams, because that was something I was really passionate about and knew a lot about and knew that I could make a good video out of. So like that whole initial 8 months of doing one or two videos a week was in preparation for this video that I released in April the following year, which was about how to prepare for exams. And that video was the first that really popped. And that sort of was the sort of started the hockey stick growth at the time.
Yeah. Isn't it funny how you almost kind of know, you know, you're like, okay, these videos have potential, right? And you never know specifically which one, but there's always videos that, okay, there's potential with this. You know, maybe you make 4 to 20 of those videos and like one of them has to gain a little bit of steam. And that looks different for anyone. That could mean, oh my gosh, it gets 500 views. And that's just insane. But yeah, I imagine that you were strategic, right? With your titles, with the content. You knew there was people out there that needed help with these courses, right?
Yeah, I knew there was some potential, but I think, I guess you've got this as well, where, you know, I didn't want to put too much expectation or hope because it's such a random thing. I just had in the back of my mind that this could potentially go big, but I don't want to even think about it just in case it doesn't. And that would be disappointing.
Totally. One of your big videos is how you take notes on your iPad Pro, and
that video is the gift that keeps on giving.
I mean, it has 4.4 million views.
Yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to see how you bring your tech into your world, and people seem to be very receptive. People love note-taking too, right?
Clearly,
And it makes me curious, what do health professionals use tech-wise? Are there nurses that carry around iPad Pros? This is through the lens, obviously, of note-taking for school, but what tech do actual medical professionals use? Is it still pen and paper clipboard? Do they have iPads? Is it one certain laptop that everyone has? I'm genuinely curious.
So kind of like in the UK, it kind of depends on where you go, but for the most part, it's not very advanced. The majority of the hospitals in the UK still use pen and paper for everything. In some hospitals, they would use pen and paper for their notes, the patient record. But then to get blood results, the pathology lab would use some command line interface where you literally have to log onto a terminal, you know, SSH into some random ass server, you know, type in the right user details, and you sort of navigate. It's completely absurd seeing kind of nurses and doctors and stuff using command line to just access blood results. In the last few years, it has sort of moved on a bit. Now, for blood results, often there's like a web interface, you know, back from which looks like it was made in the early 2000s, if not the late 90s, very sort of Windows 95 style. Some nurses have these apps on their phone where if they're recording someone's blood pressure, you know, the vital signs, they would insert it into the app and that would automatically sync to the electronic record. So that's considered like high tech. So depending on which hospital you go to, sort of those levels. At the hospital where I was working, I was the only one who used an iPad. And because we were using Epic, which I think a lot of US hospitals use as well, that they had an iPad app. And I was like, oh, this is amazing. And everyone would be like, oh my God, how are you doing that on your iPad? Is that legal? And I had to explain a lot. Like, look, guys, it's a secure service. Patient data is not being compromised, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, it's quite backwards in that sense.
Do you think that's why the security of it? Is that why they're nervous about advancing to new technologies? Why do you think that is? Because you would think the medicine field should be the most really advanced one.
Yeah, you would think so. I think one of the problems in the UK is that because it's entirely the NHS, the National Health Service, it's completely state-owned, and the NHS is the country's biggest employer. In a way, there's no real incentive for innovation. Whereas in a more private system, then you kind of have that profit motive that's driving things. So a lot of things in the NHS take a lot of money and end up not going anywhere because it's such a huge organization, and the bigger the organization gets, the more slowly it has to move. And then alongside that, there's all sorts of issues about data protection. And I think for the vast majority of people probably don't really care. And like I would love to have like a medical card where that had all my notes on it, and I could just give it to a doctor wherever in the country
instead
I went.
We fill out so much paperwork here every time.
Yeah,
it's insane.
Yeah, it's insane, and it's kind of the same here. But I think a big problem is that there's going to be that small percentage of the population that will complain loudly whenever any politician suggests, oh, maybe we should have a centralized system for patient records. They're the ones that are going to be like, no, patient data, I don't want my data anywhere. And in sort of pandering to that tiny percentage of people, I think the whole system sort of backtracks a little bit. That's just my view.
So you don't have to answer this at all. I can just cut this out. But I think it is interesting because always in the US, we're always having this discussion of our healthcare is so expensive. And I feel like it would be interesting to have an opinion of someone who's in it, who has the experience with the NHS, which a lot of people look to say, hey, look at them, look at what they have. But like you said, when the same thing that makes our system kind of corrupt, you know, the medicine for profit, is the same reason why I think there is more innovation over here in terms of developing solutions, because there is that for money incentive. Do you think that there is this beautiful marriage of the two, or because I know it's almost like a weird political question, but it's almost like you're inside of it. What do you see the things that work, that don't work? What benefits, you know, the end consumer, which is the patient?
Yeah, honestly, I think the main benefit of the system here is that, like, money does not play into it at all. Like, you know, I was doing placements at, like, one of the world's leading cardiothoracic centers where a patient is getting, a team of 20 people to do this super, super advanced surgery on them. And I was just like amazed at how this could possibly be free, even though it's going to cost hundreds of thousands of pounds for all the stuff to go on. And the patient doesn't pay a penny, and it's just a great service. So I think that side of it is really, really great. Like, no one is turned away because they can't pay. But equally, then you also have these issues associated with kind of less good working conditions. Doctors and nurses and all healthcare professionals in the UK constantly complain about how they're underpaid. These days, a lot of doctors are moving away from the UK to Australia, America, Canada, places where the working conditions are supposedly better, and you definitely get paid more. So I think once you decide whether you want a fully private or a fully public system, at that point, all of the other things are secondary to that. So I think there's probably some kind of middle ground, some happy marriage of it, but I don't think we've been able to solve that just yet.
Right. No, exactly. And then it's almost the combination of the crazy insurance companies and the healthcare system here, where it really isn't, you know, it isn't fully private. So you have all of these subsidies that are just, it's just so complex too. And, you know, you hope to see that there's this perfect solution, but it seems like no one's cracked it. People always talk about, you know, the Dutch and all the people who have it on lock, but then you see their population and it's 4 million
people.
It's
tiny. Yeah, exactly.
And it's tiny. Yeah. And it's like, well, I'm sure someone smart will come along and solve it one day.
Yeah. One day, fingers crossed.
Yeah. But, you know, what you said there with the patient not having to worry about that, I don't think there should be a price on someone just trying to stay alive, right? Everyone wants to stay alive, no matter how much it costs. So yeah. So why is it so expensive here to just stay alive?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So what gets you most excited in the health space? And then we'll pivot to more content creation, but I'm personally intrigued by your profession. Is there something that, you know, you said anesthesia, or something of biohacking? Are we going to live longer in the next 40 years? Do you know any secrets, Ollie? Tell us, what are you most excited about in this field?
Okay, so I think there's two things there. That's the sort of what excites me about the day job, and then what excites me about the field in general. So what excites me about the day job is really just the talking to patients aspect of it. like I'm on obstetrics and gynecology at the moment. And so I talk to a lot of ladies who come in with bleeding in early pregnancy and who get a scan and it turns out they're having a miscarriage or an ectopic pregnancy and might lose one of their fallopian tubes or something. And that is like a really big deal for them, obviously. And so like one of the bits that I really love about the job is being able to have these conversations and sometimes even difficult conversations. You know, if you have a patient who's having trouble with their periods for the last like 8 years and no one's been able to solve it, and it's really affecting their life. As a doctor in that position, you're in a very privileged and in a way like really interesting place where you're sort of navigating this and kind of doing it in a nice way while being nice to the patient while also applying your medical knowledge of it. So I think that side of it is the bit that I most enjoy, the sort of talking to people bit. And I suppose like in general, I am very interested in all this biohacking health stuff. I recently started listening to Dave Asprey's Bulletproof Radio, and I've now started kind of looking a lot more into, you know, all these supplements and drugs that you can take and how they work to combat aging and mitochondrial function. And I think that's such an important part of life. And I don't know if you've seen the that CGP Grey video, I think it's called the Myth of the Dragon Tyrant or the Fable of the Dragon of the Dragon Tyrant.
I haven't seen it.
So that's an amazing video, and it's like a really well animated kind of story about this.
His videos are so good.
Yeah, his videos are incredible. But it's like it's this amazing story of this town where everyone in the population, like there's this dragon on top of a mountain, and everyone in the town, you know, every year they have to send 100 people to the dragon to be sacrificed, and everyone just starts treating this as a part of life. They start saying that, well, you know, life only has meaning because ultimately, you know, you're going to be fed to the dragon. And it's this very, very long extended metaphor of the idea of aging and how we just think of aging and death as something inevitable. And we even say things like, you know, it's only because life is so short that, you know, life has meaning. If we all live forever, then we'd have no meaning in life. But then in this video, they talk about this, the idea that one day they're going to make a missile to kill the dragon. And they realize that actually we should have started this research 100 years ago. Like there are so many people that have died to the dragon because we haven't bothered putting research and money into finding the missile to kill him. And it's similar to anti-aging research, that it's something that most people don't know is even a thing. And if we think about the amount of people that we lose to age-related conditions like heart disease, cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's, dementia, all of that stuff is strongly associated with age. So if we can tackle aging, then potentially we could save so many more lives. And that's an area that I think is really, really exciting, that is very underexplored kind of in the general discourse.
That's amazing, because I feel like that permeates everything, where, you know, the first person runs a 4-minute mile. No one has done it ever. And then the first person does it. And then all of a sudden that next year, several people are doing it because, oh, it's possible, right? It's almost like you need that first person to lead the charge, say, hey, let's think differently. Let's do something that is a little out the wheelhouse. And then once that first person does it and proves that, hey, this might be a little productive, then they will come, right? That's super intriguing.
Absolutely. So I'm very excited about the area. It's something I'm trying to follow a little bit more, and we'll see, maybe try and make some content out of it.
Oh, totally. Do you follow Tim Ferriss's stuff and all the psychedelics and the things that he talks about? It kind of loses me when he talks about it, but it does seem interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I follow Tim Ferriss for absolutely everything except the psychedelic stuff. Like anytime he talks about psychedelics, I kind of think, oh man, another episode where I really don't care about psychedelics. And it's interesting, and I've heard Sam Harris talk about it as well. And it's an area I do want to explore a little bit more. But in the UK, we are so behind on anything being legally legalized. I've got this idea that one day when I go to America in a state where kind of cannabis is legal, I would love to just sort of be in a controlled environment where I'm doing cannabis or mushrooms or something and kind of filming it, you know, for research.
That would be interesting.
Ostensibly, but
yeah. Oh, that's cool. Interesting, because I'm sure there's videos out there of that happening, but I never even thought about, you know, looking that up. This podcast is brought to you by B&H Photo. Thank you so much for sponsoring. And just here to remind you that, y'all, B&H doesn't just have all of the things when it comes to photo, video, every single camera that you can imagine, all the little accessories, all the little C-stand stuff. That's what I've been buying recently. A lot of podcast equipment too. Like, when does it end, you know? but they also have a lot of great resources on their YouTube, their Instagram, Twitter, and also their B&H Explora blog. They
have a lot of dedicated people who just write blog posts, and they're super informational. They let you know, they help you inform your decisions. So thank you so much, B&H, for sponsoring. Right now, I'm talking on my podcast on the go setup. The first section that you guys heard in the beginning was actually on the iPad Pro 2020. So you can compare, you know, what I can already notice is, of course, the iPad is a little bit more tinny. It lacks the bass, you know, but it actually does an amazing job considering that is coming from a tablet. And I feel like it did a little bit of like noise cancellation on its own, because I am in a hotel right now and, you know, there's a steady flow of air just coming in, and I couldn't really exactly hear that on the iPad. So I'm curious what this will hear or sound like in your AirPods, in your earphones, in your headphones, the difference. And I assume the biggest difference is just the bass, but this is by far my most favorite setup, the H6 recorder, just plugged into these really simple mics that I travel with. And sometimes I even use in my office, the Shure Beta 58A. They look like any normal microphone that people would be using on stage to podcasting with. And they're pretty, you know, they're not too bad. I think they're like $149 or something like that. So yeah, you guys know always my links are in the show notes below for the podcast equipment that I use and the cameras that I use on the daily. And it's interesting that I'm documenting some of my thoughts and the gear that I have through this podcast, because I'm already convinced that I need to, after 2 years, 3 years of using the GH5s, I think I've come to the conclusion, after watching a ton of videos, after reading the B&H Explorer blogs on some of these cameras, that I think I'm going to test out the A6600s for my podcast setup, because it has no record limit like the GH5. But then I could, you know, the lenses would be consistent of what I use for my YouTube videos, the A7 III. So I'll keep you informed on that. Right now, you know, of course, I'm not really looking to buy a ton of cameras right now. I'm just focused on creating content. And I think that's something that maybe will resound with you right now, as maybe you're stuck inside. Just what can you create with what you have? I know I have had so much fun with my new, I got like the Tamron 17-28 f2.8 wide lens. I switched over from the Sony 16-35 f4 to this lens. And it's honestly the only lens I've been using for the past couple weeks, my Sony A7 III. And I've been kind of, yeah, I've been having fun just like tweaking the picture profiles and the color. And it's amazing once you kind of strip away a lot of the stuff, you kind of just go to back to the basics, to a simple one lens, one camera, one mic, and you just make the content. Things can be fun again. But then of course, yeah, I'm always looking online for the next piece of gear. Anyways, it's so funny that these spots start as just like, oh yeah, plug B&H for 60 seconds, but then Sarah starts to rant about cameras for 5 minutes. So I need to respect y'all's time. Let's get back to Ollie. He's so smart. It's such an honor to know smart people like this. Thank you, Ollie, for being on the podcast. Okay, let's get back.
So you have a lot of content, obviously, around Cambridge University. A lot of your time has not only been spent studying, attending, but also making videos about your experience. And again, it's one of those things where it has nothing to do with me, but they're super fascinating. And one of your videos that did really well was saying, you know, you ranked first at Cambridge University. Here are things that I did in order to study, do better on these essays, XYZ. And I know you already have a great video about this, but I think it'd be interesting to dive in a little bit on this podcast about something you talked about, the essay memorization framework. And first of all, how do you learn about these certain frameworks that helped you study? Was it through podcasts, other YouTube? Like, is it in some book in the library that you just stumbled upon? Because like a lot of things in your YouTube channel, I'm like, I've never even heard it. Like, this would have been helpful.
Yeah. No, so the first time I heard about all this kind of effective studying stuff, well, in some random psychology lecture that we had in my second year of med school, and like every single person in the year walked away from that thinking, wow, why the hell haven't we heard this stuff before? Because it was all stuff about, you know, how does memory work and how do you actually retain stuff? And like all of medical school is just about memorizing an absolute torrent of information. So kind of, I walked away from that thinking, oh my God, my life has been changed by this lecture. And then I found out that there's actually this whole world of research where people have actually studied this topic, and it's just not very well known. Like, no one gets taught how to study or how to learn. And the fact that you shouldn't take notes.
Because that's what I was thinking.
And, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, what the heck? Why have I never heard of this? So break it down for us a little bit.
Okay.
And so, why did you, just you saying why you shouldn't take notes. Excuse me? Explain.
Right. So essentially, there's a handful of techniques that work and a handful of techniques that are popular, but that the evidence shows don't really work as well. The things that don't really work are rereading your textbook or rereading your notes, highlighting your notes, and summarizing your books, i.e. taking notes. And that's like such a common thing that we do as students. We think, okay, I'm going to take notes from the textbook, I'm going to summarize it in my own words, and then I'll highlight the bits that are important, and then I'll reread them over and over again in order to prepare for my exam. And that's just the default thing that I also used to do when I was in high school. But actually, if you look at all the evidence that's been, all the research that's been done about this, those techniques are fairly towards the bottom of the pack of effective studying techniques. The things that do make a difference is something called active recall, which basically just means testing yourself on something repeatedly. And the idea is that as you try and work hard to retrieve information from your brain, the act of that effort strengthens the connection with that information. So that's like the fundamental component of effective studying, that you actually have to do the practice to get the thing out of your brain. But it's sort of like, you know, practicing any musical instrument, like playing the guitar, you actually have to do the practice, and it's really hard initially until it becomes second nature. Whereas for studying, we think that it shouldn't be hard. We think that it should be easy. And if it takes us a lot of brain power, we think we must be stupid and we're not doing it right. But actually, it's supposed to be hard, and that's exactly how you learn. So that was like the main insight that I gained from all this stuff that I kind of preach about all the time on the channel.
So how do you practice that? Do you, instead of, you know, rereading the notes or whatever, do you make up questions from your notes and then do the note card thing, and that's how you test yourself? How did you find yourself doing that act of trying to recall that information?
Yeah, so I've had loads of methods for this over the years. I think flashcards, there's apps these days like Anki and Quizlet, which are really good for kind of specific tiny bits of information, like when was the Battle of Hastings? Oh, 1066. You know, that's one small discrete fact. A flashcard is really good for that. But I find just kind of generally writing questions for myself to be like the best way. So a friend of mine, I made a video about this, a friend of mine literally didn't make any notes at all throughout the whole year. He just wrote a list of 500 questions for himself. And his way of studying was just going through the questions and flagging up the stuff he didn't know the answer to and then looking it up. And he ended up ranking like second in the entire year, you know, of these like super competitive students just by asking himself questions. So I think that worked really well as well. And then the final one that I always tell people is the Feynman technique. Have you ever heard about this?
No.
So there was this physicist called Richard Feynman who was famous for being like a amazing educator, a teacher, etc.
I know who Richard Feynman is, but I don't know Feynman.
No, quite.
Don't judge me too hard, guys.
But yeah, the Feynman technique basically is, could you explain this thing to a five-year-old? And if you can't, then it means you don't understand it enough. And then you sort of figure out, you know, you would keep asking why, because a five-year-old would keep asking why. And if you keep asking why, you eventually get to the simple truth of how it works. Mm. And when you can explain it simply to someone, that means you really understand it. And that's another thing that I preach about a lot on the channel.
That's so good. That's why I think YouTube is so special, because how I got my start with showing behind the scenes of creative work was right after I learned and put it into practice. I would literally meet up with a friend. Listen, can you explain this shutter, ISO, and aperture to me one more time? Just one more time. And it wasn't after maybe a week or 2 weeks that I really started my filming adventure that I was teaching people on the internet. And there would be comments like, oh, this is so much more simple than other people have explained it. Because sometimes when you're in it and you've been in it and it's become second nature, it is hard to explain it to someone like they're 5 years old, right? Because you're so in it.
Yeah, absolutely. So. And I think like that's one of the pieces of advice that I always give people who could come ask about, you know, how do I start a channel? It's that, you know, I think a lot of people have this view that they're not experts in a topic, therefore they're not qualified to teach the thing. Whereas what I tell them is like, no. The very fact that you're a beginner makes you more qualified to teach shutter speed, ISO, you know, aperture to these people than compared to someone who's been doing it for 20 years, because they don't appreciate what the beginner's mind is like. I think that's a positive 100%. Rather than a negative.
Exactly. And then you have the storytelling aspect of showing that journey. Hey, here's XYZ, but also guess what I'm trying to do right now? Follow along. watch the next video to see how I've improved. And then there's a story attached to it. You know, you going through school during med school. Ooh, that sounds a little dramatic. Is he going to finish? What's going to happen with that test? Like, it's like, it's an exciting journey to follow.
Yeah. And that story thing is something I think you do really well that I'm trying to incorporate more into my videos, because I really want to be able to make the sort of videos you do where you're sort of semi-vlogging, but also talking about an important thing. Whereas for when I vlog, I often feel as if I'm just being like, so guys, now I'm brushing my teeth. Now I'm going to the mall.
Right. Whereas, it has to like serve a purpose, right?
Exactly. And people like you and Peter McKinnon and Casey and Maddie Hapoja and all these guys, they tell a story through their vlog. And that's something that I'm trying to get better at.
Yeah. Yeah. You use the app Notion a lot. And I've gotten better recently with productivity, actually being able to step back and, you know, I'm working with more people now and adding process to things. I think maybe people like you who are in these fields and have to study a lot, medicine, engineering, you know, I'm a dropout. I wouldn't say that I have a very organized brain and I was successful at that, but I feel like naturally you guys are kind of better at having a structure around your life. And my means of, you know, some productivity apps that I use all the time is OneNote, because it's really good cross-platform with iPad and the PCs that I use, and then my iPhone. But I've been using Asana a lot lately for like project collaboration and working with other people and laying things out. Why do you like Notion and how do you use it? And maybe if you can describe it a little bit to people, maybe they can visualize it. Is it similar to the Trello and Asana where it's using tiles? I've used it a little bit to where it is more of like a whiteboard and you kind of, you know, decide what you want. How do you use it and why is it still your tool of choice? Just talk a little bit about that.
Okay. So I think Notion is interesting because the way I think of it is like, it's sort of like having your own website with its own like content management system. But like, instead of having to write HTML or kind of, you know, struggle with kind of hacking WordPress to your needs, which is something I've been doing a lot over the last few years, instead of struggling with all that stuff, instead you've got this beautiful interface. You can easily create a link to a new page. You can easily create a table. You can easily add images. You can sort of do whatever you want. And I think it's what a website content management system should be. It should be that open, but also that beautiful to use. And so sort of approaching it from that, it's like a blank slate that you can turn into anything. And so some of the things that I use it for is I do use the tiles feature, which is sort of like Trello, where you've got kind of a tile and you drag it across different bits. And I use that to plan out my videos. Like, it would start off as an idea, and then it would be a draft, and then it would be ready to film, and then ready to edit, and then ready to publish. And you would kind of drag the tile along, sort of Trello style. It's also got like a really good table feature with sort of databases built into it. So I use that to track my workouts at the gym. Some people use it to track habits and stuff. And it's just got all sorts of features that are sort of, it's not great as like a sort of note-taking app. It's more, I think it's better as a sort of project management app. So similar to Asana or Basecamp, but more like you can turn it into whatever you want. So I use it to manage most aspects of my life. I don't really use it a lot for actually taking notes. I tend to actually use Evernote and Ulysses and stuff for that, because I think they're a little bit better in terms of offline functionality and search and those important things. But Notion is great for project management-y stuff.
Yeah. Are there certain plugins for Evernote in Notion where you can link Evernote notes? Or, 'cause that's where I find the frustration with a lot of these productivity apps is you're using so many of them. And I oftentimes want to simplify them because not a lot of them talk to each other.
Yeah, exactly. Unfortunately, Notion is not very good at talking to things. So they haven't opened up their API yet. So even stuff like Zapier and IFTTT and stuff don't work with Notion yet. But hopefully one day when they open up their API, which is apparently planned for this year, at that point, it'll be a lot easier to kind of get different apps to talk to each other. But that's something that I struggle with on a daily basis as well. I'm like, oh, I've got like 8 different note-taking apps and I use them all for slightly different things. But I would love to be able to just use one for everything.
Totally.
But today, there's no one app that has absolutely everything. I think
Evernote
came close at one point, but then it got so bloated and performance issues and all sorts of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, OneNote is, it can be a little clunky in places. Like little things where if I want to copy and paste something from OneNote to iMessage, you literally have to like paste it in a certain way, or there will be a weird, it'll paste as like an HTML file, which is so dumb. I don't know how they haven't fixed it. So there's little stuff like that, but the cross-platform use is valuable enough for me where I just moved everything to there, where I can use, my problem was because I'm using my Dell XPS 13 so much lately, it's the 2-in-1, where I have the pen and I'll, because I like to physically write, so I'll write notes and I needed an app where I could use the pen on a 2-in-1, but then also on my iPhone. And OneNote is really the only one that does that, because no one comes over to the Microsoft store. Like, no one sees the 2-in-1 market as a thing that they're interested in, which is so weird. It blows my mind that, I feel like we've both talked about this app. What's the note-taking app that's really good for students, and why am I blanking?
Notability?
Notability, yeah.
Yeah.
I use that, but they don't have a 2-in-1 app. And maybe it's because they don't want to support it. It's much more simple to maybe be in the iOS, macOS system. But I find that frustration too, because I use, what is the other? So I use OneNote, but then I use Things. Have you ever used Things?
Yeah, I've started getting back into Things, but that's Mac only. So what do you do?
Exactly. No, yeah, exactly. And that's why so many of my things before were Mac only. So this is the only one that I still use that is. But this I found is just so good for random ideas and keeping those, you know, organized. Maybe is Notion. Does it have a web app where you can just log in?
Yeah, it's got a web app, and it is cross-platform, which is good. But it's just it's not very good at kind of quick capture. Like, you can't just share something to Notion and expect it to be in the right place. Whereas OneNote, Evernote, they're all good for that sort of thing. And I think if I was using a Windows device regularly, I would definitely use OneNote, because cross-platform is just a dream.
Yeah, yeah. So for me, Things, OneNote, Asana, and you are Evernote.
I'm like Notion. Evernote, Notion, Notability, Things, Ulysses, Bear, Drafts. It's a complete mess. I need to simplify.
Wow, consolidate. I need to
get some Matt Diavella minimalism into me.
Yes, exactly. Oh, that's so funny that you use Evernote and also Bear. Is it broken down, like one's for study, like more schooling, one's for life? I mean, how do you use both of those?
So Bear I use because it's such a joy to take notes on, whereas Evernote I use because I have to, because there's nothing that is as good as Evernote for, you will want to chuck a PDF in, an image, a scan of your note, physical notes, text, a web page. Evernote just does that so well, but it's so slow and clunky and annoying, whereas Bear is so beautiful. So yeah. I love
no,
Bear.
No, it is.
That. Yeah.
It is. You and your brother are super smart, and I very quickly realized that when I was on Yale's podcast. Your podcast is with your brother. It is called, what is it called? Not Overthinking, right?
Yeah, that's the one.
Not Overthinking. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thanks
yes.
for being on that. I feel like that was a good episode. It was nice having a different perspective. The fact that you're American and a YouTuber and stuff was like really interesting. Yeah.
I feel like I dumbed it down a little bit, but hopefully it was entertaining and helpful.
It was very entertaining and helpful.
Good. I'm curious, how did you guys grow up? And do you have other siblings? What were your parents like? What was home like? Because a lot of times people try to break down, oh, okay, this is how I'm going to get super smart kids and they're going to be super productive. But it never seems like a formula. It's always a mixture of nature versus nurture. So how did you guys grow up?
Yeah, so we were both born in Pakistan, and then we moved to southern Africa around the age of one or two. So that was a country called Lesotho, which is surrounded by South Africa. So it's sort of landlocked by South Africa. And we were there for like 5 years growing up. And that just kind of seemed very normal at the time. We went to like the local school and with all these kind of African kids and stuff, and just completely normal, because that's all you know. And then we moved to the UK when I was about seven years old. So my brother would have been six. And my mum's sort of focus was always on education, which is why we moved to the UK. So she was a doctor working in Africa. And then she moved to the UK first and took her exams and started working as a doctor here. And my mum's single. So like while she was at work, my grandma would be living with us and would like, and my grandma was a teacher actually. So she would teach us like English and maths and, you know, make us do sums and stuff at home. So that was how we sort of grew up. But then when we started high school, my brother and I both became addicted to this internet thing, and he would spend all his time on forums, and I was the kind of learning web design at like age 12 and kind of doing all these, you know, things like that I used to do back in the day, you know, like where you design, you like pirate Photoshop CS2, and then you design like an avatar for your forum signature and all that stuff. So we both sort of got started with that side of things. And I think for me,
oh my god, yeah. I remember that forum signatures. I was part of the gearpage.net.
Oh,
and that
nice.
You forget about these little things that was how you created online.
Exactly.
And like, what did your Tumblr look like? And oh, I'm going to add this custom HTML CSS and that's going to stand out. And whoa, you're like, yeah, flashbacks. Hello.
Yeah, all of that sort of stuff. And then at some point I decided I wanted to make a game. So I tried learning PHP to make a game, and I didn't realize how complicated it was going to be. But, you know, that taught me PHP, and then I started doing freelance stuff.
So you did it?
Yeah.
You made the game?
Oh, God, no. I tried making the game and then realized this is impossible. So then I just started doing like freelance gigs on like rentacodo.com. And obviously, because I was like a kid, I was undercutting everyone except the Indians. I don't know how the Indian agencies managed to accept such low prices. And then with my brother, he watched The Social Network when he was like 14, 15 and absolutely loved it. And suddenly he was like, I need to learn to code. And so we both sort of had this sort of learning to code thing alongside going through secondary school or high school, as you would call it there. And I think this just that side of things, like the more, I'm sure this was true for you as well, like the more you hang out on these forums, the more you realize, hang on, you know, there's this whole world out there on the internet and I don't have to, you know, at least like for me and my brother, our whole thing was, how do I make money online? So there were all these kind of like, you know, obviously these like long ass pages where you buy an ebook for $29 at the end of it. But at the time we didn't have any money. So it was like, you know, what software can I pirate? What can I kind of advertise my services on Fiverr or on Get a Coder or all this stuff?
Yeah.
So that
you
was
do
kind
whatever
of
you need to do.
Yeah, man.
You know,
you got to make a quick buck online.
Exactly. And I think a lot of the commonalities is the tinkering and the curiosity. And I don't know how parents can foster that, but first of all, it seems like your mom was a badass moving her family across continents for opportunity. That's insane.
Yeah, man, it's pretty cool. I don't thank her for it.
I mean, like, how? Yeah, I mean, I guess when you have kids, that's the first priority, right? Like a better life. But the fact that she did that alone is amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
I think it's hard to really appreciate like sort of when you're in it, but like kind of looking at it from the outside, I can definitely appreciate that more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, was your grandma already in the UK or did she move with you guys?
Yeah, she kind of moved with us. So she was with us all the time in Africa, and then in the UK she was with us full time for a while. But then the UK visa laws changed, which meant she could only stay here for 6 months in the year, so she would spend 6 months with us and 6 months in Pakistan. But that was when we were old enough to kind of hang out at home by ourselves, so we didn't really need someone to look after us, as it were. And I think that was kind of good, right? Because like when my mom was home, she would be like, hey, you know, only half an hour a day on the computer. And me and my brother would look at each other and sort of laugh, be like, that's not happening. So I think the fact that we were quite kind of loose in terms of what we could do with our free time meant that, you know, we were both addicted to the internet.
Yeah. No, that's great. And I think something that I always understood, if I was excelling in one area of my life that was productive, then I had freedom in other areas. I was always doing well in school. I was doing well in sports. And I was I was very clearly putting effort into certain parts of my life that were productive. So if I just kept that up, it was my understanding that I had certain freedoms. I really didn't have a curfew because I didn't go out a lot. So when I did, they didn't care because I went out like once a month to the movies with my friends, you know. So it's like, I know, I was wild, guys. But the fact that I was spending my time in certain things that you know, could be productive down the line, I did have that freedom, which I think is so important for kids. Like, they need to be curious about stuff. They need to be just have the opportunity to seek out things to tinker with. And it is hard. You know, I mean, we're not parents yet, but it's hard to draw that line because if you're playing Fortnite for 8 hours in a day, okay, that could be productive because you could become a content creator or a professional gamer. But then where do you draw that line of like, maybe you should go outside? I don't know. What is the answer to that?
No, I think all that's really interesting. And you know, even though obviously I'm not a parent and you aren't either yet. There's all these like episodes of Farnham Street where they're talking about parenting. And I'm like, oh, this is so interesting. And I love kind of theory crafting about the idea of parenting without being a parent myself. But I think
isn't that funny? Yeah. what are some of your interests that, because for me, it's, you know, I think things adjacent to parenting, but also real estate. I have absolutely zero stake in that game. Don't own anything, not in any position to ever really, not ever, but right now in New York City, you know, it's expensive, but yeah. I'm obsessed with real estate content. I want to soak up the knowledge. I don't know why. I'll literally be at dinner parties, like spouting out all this. What do you think about blah, 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 blah? And they'll be like, Sarah, do you own, like, what is your deal? Why do you know so much about this? What are some of your interests that are maybe adjacent to what you're doing, but is there anything that is just like, oh my gosh, this, that, what is going on here?
So I'm also really interested in real estate. Like I've started getting into it over the last few years, again, through watching people like Graham Stephan and stuff on YouTube. And there's all these podcasts, you know, like the Property Hub, which is kind of specific to UK real estate. And I've just really started getting into it. It's really interesting. And it's great now because, you know, when I go to sort of the houses of my mum's doctor friends, and I'm having to kind of sit with the adults, like they all have these kind of real estate portfolios. So now I can like, it's like I've got a seat at the table and I can actually understand what's going on. I can be like, oh, you know, why did you buy a house near to London? And, you know, what's the buy to let market looking like? And all this stuff. And it just makes such interesting conversation with these kind of old men that I wouldn't otherwise really have anything in common with. So that's been quite nice.
Well, and that's so good to learn that way, you know, people with the experience, and because sometimes it feels like you've missed out, but I think there's always opportunity with things. I mean, what is that looking like for a well-off person later in life? Do they own their home and then they own three other things that they rent out, or are they part of commercial projects? Like what have you consumed from them that has been working for them?
Yeah, so it's. I mean, part of it, I think, is they all came to the UK like 30 years ago, back when house prices were super low. And so when you were a doctor 30 years ago, your
salary... Where's the opportunity?
Exactly, yeah. Whereas now the house prices have gotten so high relative to how much people are earning. Like, it's a lot harder. But I think sort of their general strategy is sort of try and buy a house on a mortgage every few years, put it out on rent, you know, do it up nicely.
Every few years, wow.
Yeah, because the way buy-to-let works in the UK is as long as you have the deposit, then you can get a mortgage sort of just based off the amount you can charge on rent rather than the amount you make personally. And so if you can save up, you know, $15,000, $20,000 every few years, which is doable, then you can just kind of keep on churning out houses.
Yeah. And then there's so many different types of loans that you can get. You can get loans against your own house. And it does seem like there is a never ending way to borrow people's money.
Exactly.
But that always, as someone who like, I grew up in a very frugal household. And even though I love credit cards, like a lot of people around me, you know, would like do the Dave Ramsey thing, like no credit cards, all cash. So there's always something in the back of my mind that's almost like scared of loans and interest, but there's so many ways that you can use it to build wealth, right? And clearly if these people, that's so fascinating.
Yeah.
I don't know, that just seems like such a big like step to take. Every few years, you know, just buy a new house.
Buy a new house, yeah, stick it on rent. You know, these, and like the thing that was surprising to me is that these are all like fairly like old guys, old dudes in their 50s with like kids.
Yeah.
But they're like managing their rental properties using like an app, like Open Rent or something, and sort of just finding a tenant through the app and sort of getting the payments through the app and all this stuff. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's very forward thinking. I wouldn't have expected that.
They're just being the investors, right?
Yeah.
That's what makes me nervous is for us, with both of our professions, it's our time that's the most valuable, right? So if I feel like I'm taking up my time to go fix a door or something, like that's not a good use of my time. But it sounds like there's a lot of things that you can now do to delegate that pretty easily. And then I guess you can just be the person who's buying it up. It's fascinating. But see, you can't buy anything here with a $20,000 down payment. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, no.
John and I are over here like, okay, so if we need $200,000 for our first down, we should probably start saving now. It's just
I've got some cousins who live in the Bay Area, and they came over to the UK a few weeks ago, and we were talking house prices. And I just casually kind of, there's a question that I like to ask kind of people that I meet, which is that, you know, if you won the lottery, would you still do your day job? And I ask this to doctors to check whether people really enjoy medicine. And these guys from the Bay Area were like, oh man, if we won the lottery, we could get a down payment on a condo. And I was like, whoa. Those house prices must be expensive.
Nice accent, by the way.
Thank you.
That was amazing. Yeah, that was great. oh, that yeah, San Francisco has to, that is a bubble that has to burst at some point, because it's just, it's to the, and I was just there recently and it is so beautiful. Like, I get it, right? When there's so much talent there and then it's so beautiful, I definitely get it. But at some point, there's going to have to be something that happens where, you know, they either build more, but then I guess people are super nervous about their current houses and the current prices, you know, devaluing if you build more. But I'm like, there needs to be affordable housing. It's just, it's crazy. It's crazy. But I'll throw this in your arena, because this is something I've been thinking that is similar, you know, the way we think about real estate of, oh my gosh, you know, these older people, they've had these opportunities and they're cashing in on them later. You have to think about different things to invest in. But I feel like where we are native, where we have the upper hand, is this landscape that is digital.
Oh, right? Yeah.
And I'm starting to think, I'm just like, how can I invest in digital in a way that it is beyond me? It is growing exponentially, you know, year after year after year, to where our kids will look at us and be like, oh man, this is so saturated. This area is so expensive, but you were in it in the beginning. You had influence, you had, you know, and I've been trying to ideate around that, because I don't even know what it looks like, because it's already so much work for us to figure out what it is for us. You know, I truly feel like this is maybe you start out 50, 100K, and then I truly don't see, it's a lifestyle business. I truly don't see you topping more, or at least me, more than a million without having to delegate like crazy. Mm. And there's only so much you can do through your personal brand, right?
Yeah. But, no, that's something that I think about on a daily basis as well. Like, with all this real estate stuff, I've been thinking, you know, I suppose what I could do is I could kind of spin off my sort of limited company that the YouTube stuff is in to like a separate investment company, and then maybe by trying to get a mortgage, blah, blah, all this stuff. But then I think that, you know, if real estate is an asset class, then, for example, an online course is also an asset class. And like having a class on Skillshare, you know, probably not sponsored, is also an asset class. And having kind of YouTube videos is an asset class, because an asset is something that makes you money over time. And so There was a class I made on Skillshare like a few months ago, and that is just doing insanely well. It just took me like one day to film how I edit in Final Cut Pro, and even with just like 3,000 students, that's making like a few thousand dollars every month. And I'm like, whoa, this is completely insane. Like, to make a few thousand dollars a month in real estate, you have to have like 8 properties that are making, you know, positive cash flow.
That's good.
And I was thinking that, you know, if that is an asset class, then surely I should be spending my time just churning out more Skillshare classes and more online courses or writing an ebook, because all of that stuff surely has a higher ROI than trying to get into real estate, which is a game that people like you and me are not well, you know, placed to play, at least early on. So that's something that I think about a lot. Like, to what extent can I invest in these digital assets that will kind of make money over time? You know, hashtag passive income, hashtag financial freedom, all that stuff.
Yeah. Did you see Jake Paul's financial freedom movement thing that he launched?
He's done a financial freedom movement. No way.
Jake Paul.
Jake Paul. How? Like,
I can't even.
How does that work?
Dude, it's so bad. Literally, he made this video that's like, screw your teachers and parents. They don't teach us any. You know, it's like, it is based in some truth, right? But then you have Jake Paul standing there saying these things. And then, you know, a lot of people have made videos about it to where they'll break down what the courses are. And it's basically kind of these random people who are teaching with Jake Paul. But you could tell that they have some value, but then they'll ask Jake Paul about it. And he's just like, yeah, bro, just like do it. And then just film for free for someone, and then you can do it. And it's just like, oh man, there's no, because with online courses, and I think maybe this is something you could be helpful and speak to, you have to be teaching something that turns into a tool that someone can use, right? You can't just give out fluff. I mean, when you create a course or an ebook, what is the number one thing that you're thinking about?
Yeah. You know, trying to add value and be like, shit, you know, is there enough value in this for the end
right.
user?
Yeah. What do you see wrapping up? This hour has flown by.
Yeah, flown by.
Thank you so much for, being on. But as you look at this digital space, beyond you know, different ways to monetize it. What excites you the most? Is it different platforms, different mediums, different ways of sharing? Because it's been interesting to see even your genre of videos, which is, you know, very different. But then you have these all-stars like Dr. Mike. And it's getting popular. It's almost normalized, which is interesting.
Yeah, I think the thing that excites me is that just how many options there are for people in specific niches to just kind of make a living online. And that sounds like super cliche, but like there's so many friends that I've got who are like into really niche stuff. Like I've got a friend who's just quit his job as a lawyer because he absolutely hated it and it was the worst thing ever. And he's super into sort of left-wing politics and sort of improving sort of people's access to education and healthcare and stuff. And you know, I was just saying to him that, you know, given that you're into journalism and into writing about this stuff, you feasibly could start a personal blog, and over time you would get a following and possibly even monetize through Patreon or whatever, and you would be able to make a living doing this thing that you love. And it's still going to take a little bit of convincing for him to get started, but I just think that is such a more viable career path. And to the point where I was having this chat with my brother the other day, we were wondering, like, what even is a career these days? Like, you know, if I think of my career, I don't actually think of it, my life as a doctor, even though that's the traditional part of it. I think of this whole like constellation of stuff that I'm doing on the side. Some of it's active, some of it is passive, some of it is like sort of ebooks, some of it is physical things, some of it is being a doctor. And I think more and more people are developing this like portfolio career. I think there's a guy on the internet called Tiago Forte, if you've come across him. He's big in this like productivity space. He calls it the full stack freelancer. Where,
oh, I love that.
You have all these different skills and you're able to monetize some of them, and you're ultimately doing all these cool things that you enjoy and making a living from them. And that's what most excites me about this whole space, that there are so many more people that can now do this sort of thing. And I think it's, you know, people like you who help kind of pave the way and see that, you know, the whole content creator, that creative life, all that stuff, that this is possible. Mm-hmm. Normal people can do it. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. No, thank you. And I think that's so powerful when people realize that they do have that freedom to, I think that's an example Gary always makes, is like, yeah, bro, you could have a Star Trek podcast that's bringing in 40K a year, the same salary that you're earning from the job that you hate. Mm. And you could be living life. You know, not everyone has to, I think people like us, we have a, I don't even know what you would call it, like an all-consuming, or at least me, I'll speak for me because I don't want to speak for you. I kind of have this all-consuming thing of, I want to be doing as much as possible, because for me, I see my life in just different phases. I know there's probably at some point I'll want to slow down, but right now I literally want to be full force doing everything I can, making as much money, building as much as I can, you know, talking to as many people like you, collaborators that I have access to, that I can learn from, build relationships from. That too is very exciting, because it's not all about building, right? It's also about building with the people around you and building those relationships. So I'm full force with it, and really I don't stop. But there is a side that, like, it's not all about that. It's really about, you could probably work 10 hours a week doing your podcast about Star Trek, bringing in 30 to 50K, and bro, you're good. Like, that is so exciting to think about, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, like, I'm definitely on your page with all this stuff as well. Like, I love doing all these different things, and I keep thinking that, right, you know, in my 20s, you know, as Gary Vee would say, it's a time where you build and where you hustle down hard. And sometimes I think, oh, you know, maybe I should chill out a bit more. Maybe I should watch a few more shows on Netflix or whatever. But then I think that, like, you know, I'm sure that's the case for you as well. Like, the stuff that we're doing is just so much fun. Like, I would make videos even if I wasn't getting paid for it. But also the layer of monetization, I think, adds a really interesting dimension to it that actually kind of makes it more fun. Like, it's more fun making a video where you know that there's some AdSense at the end of it than it is just making a video. So I think we're in such a fortunate position that the stuff that we're passionate about is the stuff that we can monetize. And so, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, I can keep kind of working hard in speech marks, but I don't really consider it work, because it's just really fun. And so,
right. It's nice. And I think that probably is a factor of it, where you feel so lucky and blessed and privileged to be able to do what we're doing as a job. It's like, what, you know, like this weekend, I was working on a Samsung S20 Ultra video all weekend, the new Samsung phone. And there's a little frustrating aspects of it, of like, dang it, what I filmed yesterday was like completely wrong. I didn't turn on the certain setting. But then I'm like out in Central Park with John, like filming him skating. And I'm like, what? This is my job. Like, this is good, right? Like, this is good.
So one thing I wanted to ask you is that, so from August, I'll be taking a sort of a 1 year break from medicine to try and kind of do the YouTube thing. And I was wondering, going full time on YouTube, like given that you've done it, like how does that change your relationship with the art?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's one of those things where when it does become a job, you have to figure out how to make it feel like an escape again.
Okay.
Because in the beginning, YouTube was my escape. Video was my escape. It was the thing that brought me joy when I hated studying, when I hated electrical engineering, you know? And so I think when it becomes your job, it becomes 24/7, there is a certain level that does become mundane. There is a certain, certain times when that brand gets back to you and they have 10 points of feedback, but you never said that they were going to have creative control. So you don't even know what they're even thinking and you're having back and forth. And, you know, there's always going to be parts of the job that are like a job. But then like what I just mentioned, you know, going out and filming with John with this new phone, I was like, okay, this is pretty crazy that this is my job. This does seem like something that I'm doing for fun, right? This does seem like somewhat of an escape. So I think it's like finding things that keep you curious and almost seem like, even though they're a part of your job, they're like not. Like for me recently, figuring out my studio has like been really fun for me. It's costing a lot of money and time, and I know it goes back to the job, right? But it's been like really fun. It seems like an escape. It seems like it isn't productive, like me spending a ton of money on a freaking like curtain or something, or figuring out that one shelf that needs to go up that I haven't gotten up yet, or I don't know. So I think it's this little, it like literally today I was like, okay, the Ollie podcast, I really want to figure out this like video thing where I'm doing people remote, where I can have them on the TV behind me. Like, that sounds so goofy, but I was like excited to try it.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, I feel like he would have some patience with me. And
I guess it's so cool when that kind of thing is your job, where you can kind of play around with it, but it's still part of the job. So it's all fun.
That probably sounded super dorky.
No, man, this is great. I was actually watching your studio tour with that guy morning. Yeah, that's the one. Yeah. And I was like, oh, that peach logo is really cool. You know, and I was kind of wishing that, oh, if only I had like a brandable thing, like a peach. That's like absolutely inspired.
Well, there you go. That can be your next job, is what is the Ollie brand? But I feel like you've already done a good job. Like all your thumbnails are super consistent. And I feel like you as a brand is super consistent.
Oh, gosh. You know? I feel it's completely inconsistent. This is something I struggle really? With all the time. Because you know, like I was at VidCon yesterday, VidCon London, and Daryl Eves was giving a talk about kind of finding your niche and like making sure you're providing value to your niche, or to your niche, as he was calling it. And I just feel like my stuff is sort of a little bit of medicine, a bit of productivity, a bit of students, a bit of tech, I feel like it's a bit all over the place. But that's kind of like yours.
I'm going to
stop
you right there. Yeah, I'm going to stop you right there. Because that's what keeps it fun. If you're not interested in it, that's when it becomes a day job. Like in the past 2 years, people have noticed that I'm like really into laptops. I don't know why, but I just got really into laptops, because as phones got less interesting, I think laptops got super interesting, like with two-in-ones, and noticing, oh my gosh, I've been in Mac land for so long that I had no idea that Windows laptops didn't suck. And so exploring that has been so fun for me, right? But then, you know, occasionally you gotta throw in a video here and there that you know your audience will maybe expect. But I think that's what keeps your stuff interesting. Like, I'm just looking at your channel right now. It's what makes it unique is you and your interest, right? When I throw some music stuff, it's so funny, that video that you mentioned with Gerald, the Gerald Undone studio tour, one of the most commented things was about the over under cable thing. And that's from my music world. That's from like playing shows and understanding that there's proper etiquette when, like, you know, how musicians tour and stuff, and packing up gear. So I think bringing in interests from the medical field, studying tech. That's what makes your channel interesting. That's what allows you to build an audience that goes beyond YouTube, right? It's something that people can come back. Maybe they don't watch you consistently, but they'll watch you for a year. They'll come back to you 2 years from now, and it'll still be interesting to them.
Yeah, I suppose. I think like the there was something that Peter McKinnon made a video about recently that I find really helpful. When he was talking about how he feels like he's been typecast into this, you know, photo video tutorials, and all his comments are like, "Hey man, stop talking about your wallets and your everyday carry. No one cares. Make a photo tutorial." But his thing was like, "No, this is my channel. I'm going to make the videos that I want, and yeah, I'll make photo and video tutorials. But alongside, we'll do a video about coffee or a video about just, you know, in my backyard or whatever." And I found that really kind of inspiring, because that's something I've been struggling with. That I feel like I've been typecast into the sort of studying tech guy. But actually, I want to make more videos about books, and I like reading fantasy books, and I want to talk about that. But those videos don't get any views, and you know, it doesn't matter. It's all good.
So maybe, So maybe you just do that once a month. It satiates that need, and your core audience is stoked on it.
Yeah.
And then there's probably even ways to pursue those interests with your podcast, with your newsletter, with, you know, your different mediums that you're pursuing. And I'll just take you through some of my thought process of this recently, because I've been kind of feeling similar, where I really do not enjoy, like channels that just respond to stuff, commentary channels. There we go. You know, I'll find myself watching commentary stuff, but then I never feel good after it, because it seems like it's just people judging other people. That's really what it seems like. But then I'll watch something, and I understand that almost those people are necessary, because they hold people accountable. Like some of the people who can be super awful on the platform, like Jake Paul or Tana or Trisha Paytas, like, you know, it is nice to have people who call out bullshit. So I've always been hesitant to voice my opinion on things, because that type of content I feel like can be so toxic. But recently I'm like, I am such an opinionated person on certain things. I will sit down with John and like rant for 20 minutes, and poor John, his eyes glaze over a little bit, because I'm talking about like influencer marketing or me just becoming infuriated from a marketing article. And I'm like, oh, I wish I could put my energy into just like a talking video about this. But then I'm scared. I'm like, oh, what will the people think? It's not fancy. It's just me talking, right? So I literally think I am going to experiment a little bit with that, with videos every now and then, where it's literally just me talking to a camera and bringing up articles and stuff. And I know it's maybe not, it's not the content that's held to the highest standard, but it's just fun for me. I love the feedback loop of putting something out there in the world and then seeing what people have to say.
Yeah, and I think in a way, like one of the charms of YouTube is in the fact that at least you know, back in the day, it used to be that it was less well produced. Like, you know, you've got someone like Matt DiVella who's producing these sort of like documentary style film worthy videos every single week. And I feel like, you know, while I would love to be able to have that sort of production value, I also think I feel like it would be a bit too much for me to do each week. And I'd actually love to be able to just sit in front of the camera and chat. And I think it's important that, you know, that style of video remains like a thing on YouTube, where everyone is sort of, you know, striving for that crispy, buttery MKBHD style B-roll, you know, for a dude to just be like, right, I'm going to talk about the phone and just literally just talk to the camera at you. I think it's nice having that variety. So that's something I'm trying to get better at being okay with as well.
No, that's true. I think that's why I love podcasts too, because it's less pressure on me.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, let's dig into you, you know, which it has been so lovely chatting with you. So wrapping things up, tell me what you expect in this next year of you taking a break. That's exciting.
Yeah. So I've actually got this master plan, right? So
tell us.
The master plan is that from August, I'll be unemployed. So I'll be able to kind of do the YouTube thing full time. And then what I really want to do is I want to apply to do a master's in the US. And I think if I can get into the Masters of Medical Education program at Harvard, that would be really cool.
Wow.
So I'm planning a sort of this year, like once I've kind of gotten rid of the full-time job, if I could make enough money from the YouTube to try and pay for these ridiculous university fees at Harvard, then it would be really cool to apply to that program and be there for 2 years. And, you know, it would be good for the content. It would be an adventure. I'll be able to meet up with people like you in real life and stuff. So that's what I'm really excited about. So I'm kind of gearing up my kind of life to go in that direction. So we'll see.
That's big. Harvard. Okay. Heck yeah. It's so funny. Usually when you talk about taking a year off or something, it's like, I'm going to go to Europe for a little bit and hike the mountains. I love that you're like, okay, school, get even more smarter.
Let's get back into it. Yeah, because, you know, I make study content and I can't make study content anymore, so I need to get back into university.
Yeah. No, I love it. It'll benefit everything. And then I imagine that would make it not easier, but it would make more sense if you wanted to be a doctor here in the States, if you had that, right?
Yeah,
exactly. I imagine it's easier to get a permanent visa and stuff.
Yeah. And then while I'm there, I'll be able to do like placements in hospitals and stuff and you know, collabs with people and things like that. So yeah, it'll be nice.
That's awesome. And excuse me for being completely ignorant, but Harvard is in the Northeast. Where is it?
It's not in Boston, is it? It's in Boston, I think.
Oh, it is in Boston?
It's like,
look at me.
It's like a mile away from MIT, which I think is in Boston.
Gotcha. But those Boston people.
My American geography is absolutely terrible. I have no idea where anything is. I know that New York is East Coast and California is West Coast, and that's about it.
Basically, if you're in Boston, it will be very easy to visit. So we'll have to do an in-person part two podcast.
Oh, amazing.
I have confidence in you.
And we'll do like a music collab. You can teach me some licks on the guitar.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, that'll be so great. Thank you so much for joining. Where is every single place that people can find you in case they're too lazy to go down there in the show notes?
Right. So YouTube, if you search for Ali Abdal, kind of difficult to spell, but if you just type in Dr. A-L-I, Ali, it'll probably come up. Instagram, same thing. Twitter, I've recently started taking to after you've talked about how amazing Twitter is. I've got a podcast called Not Overthinking that you can find on all the podcast apps. And I have an email newsletter that you can subscribe to at my website, aliabdal.com. Wow, that felt
so
like
a real
plug, kind of plug central.
No, I love it. All of the content. Ali, thank you so much for being on. This was so good. It was so good.
Thank you for having me. This has been really fun.
Of course. No, it was a blast. And make sure everyone tune in every single Monday, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever you really listen to. Share with a friend that creative life. This is such a good episode. And until next time, thank you for listening.
Stay peachy.
Such a good podcast with Ali. Thank you so much for being on. Make sure to check out his socials and stick around for the Q&A. At the end of all these podcasts, I answer three questions from the Peachy fam, from the That Creative Life fam. All you have to do is use the hashtag That Creative Life and your question will be answered. I promise you that eventually. Or you can just tweet at me, leave me a YouTube comment, because I do aggregate these questions from all over the interwebs. I'm everywhere, guys, you know. But just final shout out to BNH Photo. Thank you so much for sponsoring this podcast. Links, everything that I mentioned, are in the show notes below. And if you want to check out the iPad Pro, BNH is always really good with stacking up all of the SKUs for laptops and tablets. They have everything under the sun. And as I review this iPad Pro 2020, I'll make sure to let you know my thoughts. I think a really big, not really big, but a really great thing, words are fun, a really great thing that will come from this is the 2018 models, of course, the price is going to go down. And the biggest difference is it doesn't have that LiDAR sensor. And then it just has one less graphics core. So it might be just a little bit slower, but that price change is going to be great for people because, you know, you can get an iPad Pro for hundreds of dollars less than a few months ago. And I'm going to be honest, there's not a ton of differences with it. I'm curious, do you guys use iPads? Because, you know, I'm a 2-in-1 girl. I love my Dell XPS. I'm actually going to talk about this in the Q&A later. But right now, in 2020, I'm just now getting the iPad. It's always been super helpful, I think, for the illustrators of the world. But I think it's always been kind of just like an add-on. It's you know, people who need laptops, but they're trying to make their iPad their laptop, but it hasn't really reached that point. I think we're getting closer to that. So that's why it's kind of exciting. But yeah, if you guys want to check out anything we talked about, the BNH links are in the show notes below. All the camera gear, their blog, their YouTube channel, check it out. And let's get into this Q&A. Okay, we're starting out with a question from Brad Fogel on Twitter. For influencer marketing, how much has your personal videos, podcast marketing, getting your name out there brought in clients versus what like an agent would bring me, industry and past client referrals. Ooh, this is some big words. Also, some of your own tips and experience in deciding what sponsorships to accept and reject would be cool. Oh, Brad, I could do a whole podcast probably on this. Thank you for your question. So there's a lot of nuggets in there. So I will say that I'm talking so fast right now that I feel like I'm losing my breath. So slow it down, Sarah. I've been cooped up for several weeks. I haven't talked to a lot of people, so I get excited when you know, I'm talking to tens of thousands of my friends out there finally. Hey, guys. So let's see. What percentage is it in terms of the work I'm getting? Outreach versus inbound. So I would say a lot of it is inbound because I have been making YouTube videos since 2011, building my brand, making videos, and then, you know, very publicly since 2016, I would say 2015, 2016. And then when I had the Adobe residency, I basically went full force with videos. I had hundreds of thousands of subscribers, and I was able to really work on my brand and the types of videos that I want to create without having to worry about sponsorships. So during that time, I was really able to build relationships, and then after a year, really start to quote unquote cash in on those. That's not the right word, but I've been given the rare opportunity to not be rushed into sponsorships. That's the better way of saying it. And so once I had all that inbound stuff, you know, having a manager has really helped me, you know, take those conversations and turn them into numbers and contracts. And basically my manager takes 10%, and then I have an entertainment lawyer who takes 5%. And in between those two, I mean, an amazing team. They really make it to where I don't have to worry about a ton of those logistics, and I don't have to worry about vouching for my value. They do that for me. And it's really great because a few things will come in from, you know, he has other clients, so he'll pitch me to brands that maybe have outreach to other clients. So that would be considered, I guess, outbound, him vouching for my value. But then, so I would say probably 80% or 80% of what I get is probably just from him taking what's from in my inbox and making that into an opportunity. And then what I have to do if I say yay or nay, because I want to make sure I'm not working with just random, you know, I don't want to be selling the tea that makes you go to the restroom. I mean, that's not a good fit. That wouldn't be helpful for anyone. So once I say yay or nay, yes, they fit with my brand, then I'll usually send them just like a general description of like, hey, this is the type of video that you'll be sponsoring. And they don't have creative control over the creative, but you know, they can say, ah, that really doesn't seem like it fits. And sometimes I change it, sometimes I don't, but ultimately, you know, what I choose works out. And I've been able to, you know, build trust with some of these reoccurring brands over the, you know, past few years, like the Squarespaces and Audibles. So, and then the bigger brand work, you know, in terms of tips and experience and deciding what sponsorships to accept and reject. I think really what it has to come down to is it beneficial for everyone, for your audience, for you, of course. If someone is lowballing me and I'm going to spend a week on that sponsorship, and because I can't, you know, do things halfway. So if someone is sponsoring a video, I'm going to go full on. And if it's not for a good fee, or if I'm not stoked on the product or company, it's not going to be good for anyone. Right. So I think, and I'm talking more about this than I wanted to, but I think you just have to feel it out. In the beginning, it's hard because, you know, you're trying to build attention. People won't want to sponsor you if you don't have that attention. But I think in the beginning, it's a really good opportunity for you to go at it more as making content for the company. If you don't have an already existing audience, a lot of what I did in the beginning when I didn't have an audience was I did a lot of corporate gigs, videos for the company's YouTube channel. And I think you can use your personal YouTube channel to say, hey, I have experience in XYZ. Look at these videos I've made and let me make those videos for you. So you might not be the subject of those videos, but you can use your expertise to maybe leverage personalities within companies to help them make content. And actually, let's just go back to B&H, our lovely sponsor of this podcast. They have a lot of different content series on their YouTube channel, and they use different personalities, not just within the organization, but they also, you know, ask people in New York who are creatives to come be on their YouTube channel. So there's so many opportunities to make series that are beneficial to, you know, what the company's goals are. So maybe it's not just organic content, but it's also, hey, how can you help them make effective paid media videos? So that is for Instagram stories, Instagram, Twitter. You know, I think there's a lot of things that you can go to companies and pitch, give them a nice clean price, you know, a start to negotiate. And I think people look at this very black and white, like you have to do it how traditional YouTubers do it, like the Linus Tech Tips or whatever, where it's just very black and white. This video is sponsored by blah, blah, blah. But there's so much you can do. You know, it doesn't have to just be on your personal stuff, but you can make personal creative content for their own socials. Hopefully that gave some ideas. Hopefully that made sense. I feel like I was just rambling for 5 minutes. Okay, second question from Chappie on Twitter. Hey, Sarah, could you do a video on the Dell Mobile Connect app? I was curious how the integration works between the PC and iPhone, and I can barely find any videos on the subject. Well, Chappie, you know why you can barely find any videos on the subject? Because it doesn't really work. I've mentioned it maybe in one video, and I was like, okay, this is a thing. I'll set it up later. I proceeded to try to set it up, and not just with an iPhone, but also an Android phone, where you can basically have text messages come in through your PC, your Windows computer, just like if you had iMessage pulled up on your Mac computer. And I can never successfully set up my phone. So maybe I can contact them, because I do have, oh gosh, I don't think I have a contact at Dell anymore, but they're friendly to me on Instagram. So maybe I can DM them and I'll follow up on the next podcast or on my next video, because I think that is a big reason why people stay over in Macland, because they like answering their text messages on their computer. For me, to be honest, it is like, it's a good thing that I don't have messages on my PC desktop or on my Dell XPS, because I can throw my phone across the room and not be distracted. But I totally understand how that's something that people want to use, so I'll follow up on it. Okay, last question that I saw actually in a lot of the YouTube comments is, what laptop am I using? Because I do so many laptop reviews. It seems like I am always changing out. So let's just do a little chronological laptop Sarah Peachy situation. So in 2016, when I first discovered, holy smokes, the MacBook Pro 15s are just like garbage. What is this? That's when I switched to the Dell XPS 15 9570, which I just fell in love with that laptop. All the ports, the SD card, we love to see it. And then I moved to the Asus ZenBook Pro Duo. Loved that thing. The second display was so cool, but it's a little bulky, right? So then when I reviewed the Dell XPS 13 2-in-1, I fell in love with that computer. Again, it doesn't have as many ports as the 9570 because it is so thin. It's a 13-inch. I've always been a 15-inch laptop type person, but I just fell in love with this little guy. And to be honest, y'all, I think it's official that that is my go-to laptop. I don't think I've used another laptop unless it's for a video for the past maybe 6 months. I mean, the Dell XPS 13 2-in-1. Who would think that a 2-in-1 would become my main laptop? I can do video edits on it. I will say, if I finish a complete video on the laptop with color grading, and if it is 4K, it'll struggle. It will, but very rarely do I get to that point. Usually I'll just do initial edits on it and I'll move to a desktop, whether it's my iMac or my main gear PC at the office. But I just love this Dell XPS 13 2-in-1. So for the past 4 years, those have been kind of my three laptops. XPS 15 9570, Asus ZenBook Pro Duo, Dell XPS 13 2-in-1. So I haven't been on the MacBook Pro for 3 to 4 years, which is pretty crazy. And then I reviewed the MacBook Pro 16, and I was just so pleased, y'all. Man, you know, the MacBook Pro 15 and me have not, we haven't gelled for the past few years. I just wasn't a fan. So it was such a lovely, lovely surprise when Apple fixed a lot of the stuff that was just wrong with it. And then the performances that I saw, and I documented that in my review. I mean, it kind of crushed the Asus ZenBook Pro Duo, which, you know, was shocking. So now I can recommend, yeah, the MacBook Pro 16 to Mac users and anyone alike without feeling guilty about it. I mean, there was a solid 3-4 years where I'm like, yeah, you need to upgrade your MacBook. I mean, I don't, check out this one instead. So we love to see it. We love to see it. Okay, those are my three questions. Thank you guys for listening. If you have a question, hashtag that creative life on Twitter and tag me. Until next week, new episodes every single Monday. Thank you for listening.